All right. So good to see everybody. Please, we started last week in the fourth chapter of Gittin. We began with the Mishnah on 32, page 32, Lamed Bet, right to the heart. And the Mishnah is dealing with the fact that a husband has in his power the ability to cancel the get that he sends to his wife. He has the power to cancel the get, a get being the written document, which is the expression of the Sefer Kritzut in the Torah, a document of cutting off or separation, can be written according to Deuteronomy. A husband sends that to a wife whom he wants to be divorced from. When it is delivered to her hand, we learned last week in the Gemara, that's it, final, done. A husband writes that get. Could be that a woman heard that the husband wrote that get. My divorce papers are coming, she hears. An agent is sent with the paper. She fully expects that it's going to arrive in her hand. It arrives in her hand. Ah, but in the old days, the husband might have nullified it in front of a Beit Din, said the Mishnah. The husband called, in this case, two or three people. Interesting that they use the term Beit Din. And nullified the get. And Rashi understood that the problem might be that when she got the get and didn't know that it was nullified, she went on to get married, had children who are considered to be what are called mamzerim. Term sounds very pejorative in English. Bastard children. Children out of wedlock. And the lines of family purity, in a certain way, family values, are broken, and we have children who can't marry into the normative community of Israel. That's the problem. So we talked about whether or not the new rule of Rabban Gamliel on the Mishnah would protect against that. What's the new rule? Well, if I write a get and I'm a husband, and I send it to my wife, but I want it to be canceled or nullified, instead of organizing a local Beit Din where word might not get out to the wife, I have to do one of two things. Send a shaliach to the shaliach, or myself arrive at the shaliach. Go to the agent with whom I sent the get, myself, and say, your shlichut, your agency to deliver this get is nullified. Now, on a larger, grander scale, and this question remains somewhat open in the reading of the Gemara, even though people may have committed one way or another to their own readings of this question that I'm about to ask, this issue remains open. Is the agency nullified? Or is the get no longer a get because of what the husband says in our Mishnah?
What's the definition of the agency?
The agency is, I am hired to carry this get that you wrote. Am I nullifying the get? Is it no longer a get? Or is my agency dispensed with because I've canceled it. In other words, I no longer am your delivery person. I would say in different ways of reading the Gemara, sometimes it seems like we're talking about the agency of a shaliach, of a carrier, and whether or not I've called the guy before the bike messenger arrives to building number 205 with the bag. The document is still the document. Or sometimes I feel as though these passages reveal that there's even the possibility to nullify the original document, and that the document itself no longer is betokef. It's effectual as a legal document. But I'm not going to answer that question, frankly, because I don't really know in the end, and the passages we're going to look at are not really about that issue.
It doesn't make a difference.
Well, it does make a difference, and here's why, Herb. If the get remains a get, which is part of the worry in here, and I know as a wife that the get is going to ultimately be delivered my way, right? Then I feel tormented by my husband who will not deliver this piece of paper to me that he wrote for me to free me to marry any other individual. Society then deals with women who are caught, who are chained to recalcitrant husbands, and they are called agunot, chained women.
What bothers me legally is that the get is written and the void is oral. If the get is written, why shouldn't the void have to be written as well?
Nice. So there is the question on the table, either between the lines or sometimes even more explicitly, Arthur, exactly how you're asking it, shouldn't we really have something in writing? There are other fixes in the world that have writing.
And also, based on what he said, you earlier said he did it in front of the witnesses. Do you need to have a retraction done in front of people? Or does it have to be an explicit written statement to void it?
Interestingly, what happens if you want to think about the legal narrative is that they're saying you don't need to do it in front of people. You can do it yourself. One of the interesting questions in this Gemara is, on the legal, societal level, does allowing for individual people to cancel and nullify legal documents make for a better society than my having to go to some administrative court and do it in such a way that there is both written documentation and some process before judges and or witnesses? Do individuals with power to cancel documents make for a better society than one that requires individuals to appear before magistrates? At the core of this discussion is how a society is set up in that vein.
Last time when we discussed it, you said that Rabban Gamliel's kun olam was to protect the women and protect. So the court cannot nullify, stop this minhag of nullifying the get. Correct?
We did mention that there was a problem. We're going to look at that piece of text tonight, that some people continued to cancel their gets before courts instead of using Rabban Gamliel's new methodology.
Right. So the question that I have is why the concept to protect, to make tikkun olam and protect the women and the children is that way, the argument in the Gemara is that way, and not to completely eliminate the concept of bastards, of mamzerim. Why they don't have any argument to find a way that even children who were born, that the woman knew or didn't know that she's married or not married because the husband is a little bit cuckoo, why she cannot have a family that she never saw her husband for the last 6 years?
Right.
Why not to have a new argument and generate a new concept and eliminate the, the children's
problem? In fact, Ron, there are discussions about whether or not we should release
the children from the problem.
The children from the problem. So you're onto it. That is a discussion.
If you want to cool alarm.
If you look through halachic literature in the Middle Ages, you will see too that people are hesitant to define children in the halachic categories that would prevent them from getting married. They do everything they can sometimes to alleviate that problem. So here they don't discuss that, but it's a natural question that grows out of this sukkah. Yeah, Bonnie.
So I was wondering about other situations, you know, legally where people change their mind. And I was thinking about wills. So that's something where people will change their mind, and maybe the lawyers know. Does that have to be in writing? I mean, sometimes they argue that someone before death changed what they were going to
do. The most recent writing will take precedence.
The most recent writing.
Takes precedence.
Oneself, or in front of a lawyer, or in front of witnesses, or in front of a judge.
A will, you need three witnesses.
The same formality.
The same formality as a will. Counsel. Second will. And it must be in writing the witness.
Really?
I think according to Jewish law, you need to have two witnesses listening to the wills. I can be on my deathbed, and say something, and have two witnesses.
Here, you don't need two witnesses. You need the husband to go to the shaliach. You need the husband to approach the agent. That's what is partly radical about the takana, about the fix, the tikkun olam. In this part of the world of marriage law, the fix that the rabbi made, Rabbi Gamliel, was you decided to write this, get and deliver it. Now you have the power to actually fix it. You can stop it yourself.
So this seems to relate to business dealings that are done on a handshake. And it's really honored that way. And 47th Street with the diamonds, there's, as I understand it, Marion can attest to that because she has a cousin there. That there's a lot of dealings done just by saying, here's a deal. No witnesses, no contract. It's an honor system.
No written contract. No written contract. It's a contract if it's an oral contract. No written contract.
So let's just take that one step further. Let's say that you're in a society now, and let's say it's a given that oral legal instructions are the general way that people nullify gets and or the agency of gets. Let's leave it as both, in effect, keep the woman from getting that piece of paper and keeps her from getting her divorce. Right? So, we have spoken word from the husband or a spoken word to the from the husband to another agent to go tell the agent with the get, don't deliver. That was our Mishnah. So I told you that we were going to think about what the Tosafot bring up as a possibility. Tosafot, remember, are a group of sages that come after Rashi. They're interested in sometimes harmonizing between two disparate passages in the Talmud. They're sometimes interested in bringing us legal concepts that they know are at play in a certain sugya. And in order to help us with the holistic look that they take on a situation, printers decided to put the Tosafot, at least one set of Tosafot, one set of entries that are commentaries by this group of rabbis, on the page of Talmud. It's on the outside lane of the page instead of the inside, which, remember, we said is always Rashi. and the middle, which is the Talmud itself, the Gemara, the Mishnah and the Gemara. So the Tosafot come up with a question on a part of the text that we read. And that part of the text we read, which we want to relate to, is the part of the text that says, one may have thought that retroactively it is revealed that he indeed nullified the get. The Mishnah teaches us that there's no cancellation of either the agency or the get itself, whichever direction you go. There's no cancellation of the get. If what?
She got it.
If she got it. She gets the get, it's a done deal. Why might a person have thought that there was cancellation retroactively? Maybe they heard that the husband was running after the shaliach. Oh, I saw so-and-so running after the agent that he hired in order to cancel the get. And everybody knows that he sent the get, and everybody knows that he was running, and this guy doesn't run. But he ran after that agent. So retroactively, the question that the Tosafot want to deal with is about the halachic concept of divarim shebelev einam divarim. Words in the heart are no words at all. In other words, if I intend something, sorry, not an agreement. Now, I bring this up on the heels of the conversation that we all started about the Diamond District, I think it was, because not only was it the oral and the handshake, but I remember hearing a story from Sam Clagsburn. His father was a diamond cutter.
Right? That's a polisher.
But that there was always a way to look at somebody and kind of know that was the rate. And you could communicate without a handshake, without words, and somebody knew it was that much higher. In the Shuk in Machane Yehuda, who's been to Machane Yehuda? In the Shuk. In Jerusalem, there's an outdoor market. And if you want to know the price of peaches, at 6 a.m. you walk around and there's a little sign that says 6 shekels a kilo. But when the market starts to fill up, if you notice, the signs go away. And the first one to sell the peaches for about 8.5 per kilo will say, peaches are now at 8.5. Peaches are now at 8.5. There's an oral agreement among our friends that the price now is 8.5. Everybody's sign changes. Look, the market has to bear what it's going to bear, right? It's fair. They have to afford challah for Shabbos. This is partly how the market system works. In Jerusalem, if you hang out in the shuk long enough, you know that there are, through the day, waves of prices. It's kind of like the market, but when you don't deal with that kind of market and you want to deal with this one. So anyhow, why the tangent? The tangent is, the Tosafot want to know, if someone thought that the actions a person took were enough, that retroactively there was a get that was canceled, can I really say, divarim shebelev, divarim, words in the heart, are indeed intentional words and create legal realities. So how far will the whole process go? I said, I'm interested in this question. If I empower one individual to become the person who nullifies a get, am I going to empower that person to actually show some kind of action orientation to go cancel the get and assume that, in fact, he meant to do it even though he didn't say he wanted to do it? Tosafot are interested in this concept. And they say that Hainu Davka Kodem Shegia Get Liyada, before the get was actually delivered to her hand, Aval Im Lo Noda Oto Gilui Data Ad Achar Shegia Liyada Lav Klumhi. However, if the gilui dat was not known to either the shliach or the isha, meaning that if it wasn't really revealed by words, or until after the get was in her possession, that gilui da'at is worthless. Ein klum. If I took some action, and I went and I ran after the shaliach, and one might have thought there was some nullification, in fact there's no nullification, because there was no word spoken, even if words were spoken afterwards, and the get was in her hand, and I might want to, as Ron was saying about the children, rethink the whole conception. Maybe we don't want to encourage divorces, and therefore we want to say that if he expressed it right after she got it, that it's nullified. Forget it. It's not nullified. There's no saying that it's canceled. If it wasn't said, divarim shebelev, words in the heart, enam divarim. Those are no words at all. So I have to speak my intentions. Now, the radical nature for me, or somewhat legally progressive position, is that an individual can do it, and it doesn't need to be done in before a beit din. Doesn't need to have these two witnesses or these judges. But we're going to talk about that a little bit in the first piece of text that we're going to look at today. Yeah.
The man comes to
okay.
If it doesn't take effect until it's in her hand,
right,
which I think is right, then we can stop. Don't give it to her.
Right. Right. Here's one piece of this that we also talked about last week that is important for us in terms of the situation. The Talmud, even though we're going to think about it somewhat expansively sometimes, and we're going to philosophize about what some of the approaches of the rabbis really mean for the buildup of society, for the relationships that happen between men and women, there is an assumption in this case. And that assumption is that there was a get written, the husband wants it delivered, and that there's a question about whether or not he's just delaying it to torment her. That is an assumption of the Talmud.
Well, that comes to the question of when he says the get is batel, which he has to say to the Shishnah, according to the Mishnah, that suggests that when he says that to the Shaliach, he's telling him, your agency that I assigned you is now void.
Mm-hmm.
So he can only torment the wife when he has a get in his hands, you know, that has some life to it. But the Mishnah specifically says that when he says that to the Shaliach, the get itself is void.
Yeah, well, that's why I have the question on all of this, the Mishnah and the subsequent Gemara. Are we talking about nullifying that piece of paper? Is that get void? Is it invalid? Or is just the agency invalid?
Well, doesn't the Mishnah right. say that the document is invalid?
We can always go back. We can always go back and say it seems like it says that. But the question is laid wide open because of the subsequent conversations in the Gemara.
It seems like there are two possibilities, and there isn't much argument for one. And the two possibilities are that the wife really wants to be free and the husband is torturing her because she can't until he comes.
Mm-hmm.
But the other possibility is that the wife really wants to be married and the husband wants to be free. And she would enjoy having this cancellation because she wants to work on this marriage and she still wants to be in the marriage. But it doesn't sound as though that situation happens as much as the other.
Well, that's definitely not their assumption. The assumption of the rabbis here is that the husband is either recalcitrant and playing with her, or he's going to actually go through and completely cancel it. There's not...
Well, it's interesting, because it could be either way. You know.
I agree with you
there's no argument, there is no... they don't show that the woman can take the guest back. They don't discuss it.
So, I mean, I see moral hazard here, writ unbelievably large.
Right.
Because if somebody can write something
assign an agent to execute it, and then has the option until it's actually in the other person's hand to call it back, this encourages less than thoughtful actions altogether. I mean, it creates a whole structure that is one that doesn't encourage responsibility and decision making. I mean, I can't think of a worse bit of public policy for a society that you want people to take their actions seriously. So there must have been some reason for allowing this to occur, but from my standpoint, I can't imagine why, if I were the leader of this community, I would want to permit such a thing to go on.
You know what's so fascinating about that is that the exact opposite is one of the underlying assumptions of the Gemara. Just by way of talking it out, both say moral hazard. I would agree with you 100%, but let's talk about what the Hava Amina, when you say Hava Amina in the Talmudic discourse, it's the straw man. What's the straw man? What's the problem that I need to consider and then knock down a lot of times in Talmudic rhetoric? Here, what's the thought? What's the position of those who thought that Rabban Gamliel's takana, Rabban Gamliel's fix, was a good fix, that the individual now had to himself go after the shaliach or arrive to the wife? Well, the thought is that if I actually tell him he's the one that has to do it and trouble himself, it's going to be a lot better than if he can just call to his two best friends and say, hey, come here. You know that agent's got my get, but we're in Hutzeplatz and she lives in Yenemsveld. But over here in Hutzeplatz, all I need to do is call two guys. And I call you and I say, in front of these two witnesses, I cancel the get. And then she gets it. And by the way, nobody says anything, and it doesn't get there quickly. There's no newspaper. There's no legal notices section anywhere. And she gets married and subsequently has mamzerim. It's a problem. So their thought was, let me get rid of such a hazard, and let's go the other direction. But you're absolutely on to the question that I think needs to be asked here. How do you instill a sense of responsibility in a person when this is still possible? Agreed.
That's how it is in our society, our secular society. If I sign an agreement and send it by a messenger to somebody and I change my mind, until the other person's received it, there's no contract. I can call the vice messenger and tell them, come back, I changed my mind.
The true delivery is what affects...
Well, nowadays things can be different because you can do electronic signature. You can do an electronic signature, but if you say to somebody, let's exchange originals of the contract, and I sign it in my office and I send it off, it's not a contract until the other side has received it.
Is that true? How about if you send it electronically?
If you send it electronically, you have more trouble because you can't really rescind it. It's sort of instantaneous. Electronic signatures are valid now.
So it's not when it's signed.
If you do that, it's not a contract when it's signed. Not a contract until the other side receives it, one way or the other.
I'm not sure of that. I think someone has to opine on that who's an authority. I'm not sure if that's the case.
No, if you don't return the contract, it's not.
You're an authority.
If you take that contract, you could sign it, you could shred it.
Yeah.
And that contract is not existent.
Now, if at the same time you're signing it in your office, you tell the other side verbally, I signed it, well, then you have a different situation. But I'm saying,
you're just exchanging
original.
It hasn't been written, it hasn't been said, and if it's a very important contract, even electronically, there's a whole bunch of machinations they go through. And I know I've been doing 1,000 of them because of Sharon.
Hmm. Isn't there an inherent problem format of the divorce, which is to say, delivery of a document finished? It's not a court proceeding.
I mean,
could be a court proceeding where both parties have to
could be. Here's the progressive nature of it all, just so we put it in the context, right? Torah provided for having a sefer kritut. That was pretty forward thinking. Why is that forward thinking in and of itself? Because if you're a woman in the ancient world and you can show that you received this document, it was basically, as I mentioned last week, your papers to get across the border. This was a really important document. here too, in rabbinic culture, really important document. And to this day, really important document.
We have the same system. You have to have a judge. But both parties, when they're shlichim,
mm-hmm.
are present at the same time and are
yeah.
presumably informed of what's going
yep.
on. There's not a. I mean,
today in Israel, by the way,
to do it. If it's a contract. Mm-hmm.
Today in Israel, by the way, who saw the movie or the film that was just out? Get. Anybody go see it? It is so worth seeing. We must rent it. We must watch it as part of what we do. So I don't know if it's going to be out yet on DVD, but if it is, and we can stream it, one day we should sit here and watch it together. Okay? Absolutely. Okay? Very important. Today they're called together to the rabbinic court on the local level. So you'll see that the process, you'll see how crazy the process is too, with the notion of his being unwilling to deliver. But they're both there.
I'm not sure if you clarified this at the beginning, but are we assuming that there's not ambivalence on the part of the husband, that this is something that the wife knows is his intention? There was some discussion of they're not living together because the husband has to travel to the wife. So this is a marriage that is not, where they're not really working at it. They're separated. It's not just ambivalence on the part of the husband. Is he changing his mind?
Yeah. I think we teased out, based on your comments last week, and the larger framework of Tikkun Olam, and whether or not it had anything to do with keeping families together. And some of the comments I think Bobby was saying last week, we do have to think about, and this week, we do have to think about whether or not there is the kind of notion here of whose willingness and which side, and does somebody want to work things through. Anytime you have a human pair thinking about their marriage, their divorce, I have to imagine some people go through such thinking. You know, is it really done? It's not really done until it's done. And do we want to cancel this? And last minute, do we want to? I've been in my office with a Beit Din ready to deliver a get on behalf of a husband. And the husband calls and says, you're no longer my shaliach. Some people in this room have participated in deliveries with me. It is very much alive and well. What can happen in these moments? So I'm not denying that those things are happening. Here in the Gemara, I think it's a little bit more straightforward by way of the husband, at least one svara of the Gemara, one direction that the thinking goes in the Gemara is that we're talking about a husband who is recalcitrant and who will cause problems. But the notion that there is the outcome of children out of wedlock, of children who don't fit in with our categorically normalized way of understanding who can marry who within the Jewish community. Mom's everything. I believe, actually, and we're going to get there, and I want to now turn and make that kind of the last piece before we get to some text. I believe that there actually is that space in the Talmudic text to say they were worried that people who wanted to put their relationship back together might cause a woman to go out and get remarried when she really is not able to, because there's some will on behalf of the husband to try to put this back together, and we're gonna end up with children out of wedlock, which is the big problem for the rabbis in that sense. And then it becomes a tikkun olam issue, not just of how do I deliver this get, and is it still valid, and is she divorced or is she not divorced, but there's bigger family values thinking going on. Let's see it inside with some of this process orientation, and the discussion can continue, but I just want you to have more information that the Gemara brings out about the whole system of canceling before witnesses or judges, and this discussion of what this tikkun olam is really all about. Okay, turn to page 32b2, if you've got the Gemara in front of you. 32b2. I always say, you can just listen along and be inside. If you need something clarified, you shouldn't hesitate to just say, can we say that again? Okay? So really, that goes for everyone. Need something clarified, just say, can we just say that again? 32b2, right-hand side of the page, the Mishnah stated, Barishona haya ose. Formerly, the husband could convene a court anywhere and void the get before the court. The Gemara records the following. Itmar, it was stated, Bifnei chamahu mevatlo. In the times before Rabban Gamliel's fix, his decree, how many people did the husband really need in front of him to nullify the get? Rav Nachman Amar. Rav Nachman said, Bifnei Shtayin, before two people. Rav Sheshet Amar, Bifnei Shalosh, Shloshah Anashim, before three. I have a machloket, a disagreement, maybe, between Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet. Well, let's explain their dispute. Rav Sheshet Amar, Bifnei Shalosh, Rav Sheshet, who argues that it was before three people, says the following, Beit Din Katane, the Mishnah states that he does so in front of a court, and a court consists of three people. I know that I need three people for a rabbinic court. Throughout the Talmud, footnote mentions you need three people, and it's a well-known fact that you need three people. For Rav Nachman, Amar Bifnei Bet, Bifnei Shtayim, Rav Nachman says, though I can do it before two people, he could declare it, Leve Tre Nami Beit Din Karelu, for two people can also be called a court. And that's a very, very kind of small court. Two people are needed for the purpose of some legal actions. And you have two witnesses on a ketubah. So therefore, if I'm dealing with the opposite end of the marriage process, this is at least what one of the thinking says in other commentaries, you're onto it, then if I could have two over there, here I could have two. Makes sense. The Gemara continues. Amar Rav Nachman. Maybe we'll just say one more word about the ketubah. What are the two witnesses actually witnessing on a ketubah?
The signature.
So the two witnesses on a ketubah are witnessing that the groom takes the handkerchief from someone. By the way, it does not need to be a rabbi, though we do appreciate the business. And he could pick up a pen instead of actually pulling on a handkerchief because it's a written document. And picking up the pen says, I accept on myself all of the conditions in this ketubah. There are three main conditions for marriage that a husband takes upon himself. That is, shelter, food, and a schedule of intercourse according to the woman's desire. Those are the three things she may demand. And then there's an agreement about what price would be paid if there would be a divorce.
200 goats. If you do the math of this.
If you do the math. I've heard that calculation. Therefore, it could make sense to us in this framework of talking about marriage. Oh, by the way, last week came up the conversation and the question, monotheism versus polygamy.
Monogamy.
I'm sorry. Monogamy. Was that a Freudian slip?
something.
You can tell my wife that I have deep respect for her. Monotheism versus me. Okay. So, monogamy versus polygamy. We have only one case in the Talmud where there is two wives by any sage. With all the sages we know, there's only one case. Generally, it's assumed, imagined, and the reality that you're talking about one wife wasn't so much a monogamous landscape in Sasanian Persia for certain of the Arabic lands Jews, if you will, of today. However, we're not exactly sure that it wasn't the cultural norm in Jewish circles to have one wife only. You see that many, many ketubas that were found absolutely represent monogamous marriages. That said, Rabbeinu Gershom, what's that?
How could you tell? Somebody could have multiple ketubas, right? I mean, a man could have multiple ketubas. How
right, it's even mentioned in a certain number of cases, according to some people who have found documents, that you'd be my wife, my only wife.
Oh, okay, if it says that.
Yeah. And it's true that Rabbeinu Gershom in the 11th, beginning of the 11th century, in Europe, did have what we call the Takanah, Rabbeinu Gershom, to limit polygamous marriage. So there must have been some question. But that's the brief history.
Is there any reference in the Torah in regards to that?
Well, you see that the sages, I mean the ancient ancestors,
right,
had multiple wives. Jacob had Rachel, Leah. So that was one case. And then they had handmaidens that would become for the power of birthing children to have ancestry, lines of ancestry. And if you really look at the 12 tribes, then we don't have just Rachel and Leah. We have Zilpah and Bilhah, who are handmaidens of Rachel and Leah. So, well, that's what I said, Jews of Arabic lands. I can't say it was just Yemen, but it definitely...
South Africa.
What's that?
South Africa, that's what that Greek book was.
Well, I don't think so many Egyptian or African. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Poor people tend to be polygamous. It's a way of... I think rich people can afford it, but in the Arab world,
no, you need to be rich to have multiple wives because you must treat each one from the same. They must be equal in everything.
Give them food.
The food, the housing, everything should be the same.
I don't know how everybody lives around the world in a polygamous way, but I do know that we're arguing here about. Let's go back to the divorce end of things, and we'll go to Rav Nachman now. I'm on the bottom of the right hand column on 32b2. Amar Rav Nachman. Now Rav Nachman says, Mina aminala. From where do I derive my opinion that two men are really still called a court? We're going to get some insight. Ditnan, it's learned in a Mishnah, and that Mishnah is in Shvi. And the reason why he learns from this Mishnah is not simply because he wants to prove that two people constitute a court. He wants to hit a cymbal in the drum kit of our theme, which is about Tikkun Olam. He wants to now show that there's another way that they've created Tikkun Olam in the world. That there's a fix by the rabbis in terms of rabbinic legislation. And the Mishnah he's going to quote is about one of those fixes, right? And remember, we were asking the bigger question, if Tikkun Olam is used in modernity as the term for fixing the world through social action and the pursuit of righteousness and social justice movements, right? Because you've heard that Tikkun Olam is used for that purpose in the world today. Where did it get its roots? And what are the honest roots of this term? It's just an interesting pursuit intellectually to say, what are the roots of this term? So far the roots are with the divorce and how a person nullifies, whether it's moral hazard or not. It is the root. And here the root is about financial matters between people. the tikkun olam we're about to encounter in this mishnah that proves two people can constitute a court, is about financial matters that a person needs to deal with if he's got a loan out to somebody and is worried that the loan will be nullified in a year that he has to say, you don't owe me anything else, because of what's called the Jubilee and what's called the notion of sabbatical. And it's basically the sabbatical of kasafim, the sabbatical of money. That at the end of the year, at the end of the sabbatical year, you have to nullify a loan that somebody still owes you. So what would the problem be? If there's a sabbatical year coming up, who's going to loan money? So in advance of the Shemitah year that comes, or in advance particularly of this issue where you can't press your fellow or brother about the loan that he has to pay you back, and you must relinquish it, there is a fix made in the world, a takana, a tikkun olam, called prosbul. Prosbul is a document that allows you, as the holder of the loan, to transfer the loan to a Beit Din. The Beit Din has no obligation to release the loan, like you have a personal obligation to release the loan during that sabbatical year, at the end of the year. Therefore, the paper is still good, even though I can't collect from you during the Shemitah year. I can then subsequently demand that you repay the loan.
But it's mitzvah min Torah, so
Beit Din is not obligated to follow the same prohibition which is in Deuteronomy 15:2, which says Lo yigosh. It says you may not indeed press your brother, but it's in the individual yigosh, and it's not in the language of the court or the Beit Din or the authorities. Therefore it's him singular, and him singular means the individual, and if I can release the individual from having to give up the loan, and I can take it as the Beit Din and guard it and hold it, and I can allow for loans to be made, commerce to happen, the exchange of resources to make this society prosper, then I've created a system whereby society thrives.
Do they wait until after the year, the Beit Din, or they can do it during the Shemitah year?
It actually, if you looked at how it was done this year, as an example, because it was done by private individuals who had loans with fellow Jews, a prosbul form was sent around through the New York Board of Rabbis to all of the colleagues at New York City synagogues before Rosh Hashanah to fill out an actual prosbul form for individuals who had private loans.
I got one from KJ.
And I got to do one with someone in our community who took that mitzvah seriously. It was sent by Rabbi Lukstein and Rabbi Weinstock, absolutely, to the entire community in case you needed it.
I can't recall the details, but I did it all along.
So this notion that you have to have a fix in terms of commerce, in terms of loans, in terms of our systems for lending and borrowing and repayment, leads Rav Nachman here to say, oh, just like he fixed it over there in front of two people, so too am I going to see that we could fix this problem, or this problem could have been fixed before Rabbi Gamliel changed it, in front of two people. And he learns here about the court from this mishnah. Mosarani lifnechem. I submit before you, Ploni ufloni hadayanim shebemakom ploni, that so and so, the judges in such a place. So he uses the language that's suggested by the Mishnah that says as follows. I submit before you, Ploni, and you, Ploni. Ploni is like the name John Doe. So when I say Ploni in a Mishnah, it's the filler-in name. So I submit before you, Ploni, and before you, Ploni, in this place, that I'm writing this document to give the Beit Din the loan that you can hold on to it so that I can get it after the Shemitah year. So, what is he doing? He's making a diuk on the language. You know the term bidiuk? What's that?
I said, which pony is going to come to the first place? It says, can you call ponies? But there's two ponies.
Pony is just another placeholder name.
Yes.
So that's one judge, two judges in such and such a place. So what's Rav Sheshi going to argue back to him? Rav Sheshi says the following. Atutana ki ruch lecheshiv Uzel, must the teacher of the Mishnah actually go on pointing out every detail like some peddler trying to sell everything he's got in his possession? I have this one over here, I have that one over here, I have this one, I have that one. In other words, the language of the Mishnah, even though he said to before you, Ploni and Ploni, he didn't mean to say it was a court of two judges, and he's just enumerating, or... He's being too concrete. He was just saying that when it comes to writing the document for the prose bowl, for this document that protects the loan, he was saying, Ploni to Ploni, meaning he had to write the specific names of the judges who were on the case, in the court, and of course everybody knows, how many judges are there? There are three! Not two.
I just want to say one thing. In a court where you need a decision, you really need an odd number of people. Otherwise, you have two people, one on one side, one on the other. You can't get a decision, so you need three. Here, there really isn't a decision. It's just a matter of...
Procedure.
Two. Huh?
Well, it's procedure.
Witness.
It's well, a witness. And so you can't... One person may lie, but two people would have to sort of be in cahoots to lie together. So if you have two witnesses, the chance of, I think, some dishonesty is reduced. But you don't need a decision.
If you can convict somebody of a capital crime with two witnesses, it seems like enough to me for this purpose.
So your argument might be, back to Rav Sheshet, who says... No, he's just simply making this remark, and he doesn't mean two judges, he means the three that are constant and normal basis, you might say, but we're not dealing with matters that you need three people on a court for. You're simply dealing with witnessing, with edut. That position is definitely one that could be argued. And in fact, is the underlying assumption of what is possible, mind you, before Rabban Gamliel said that the husband had to run himself. But that is the underlying assumption that the Gemara is going to get to right here. So listen to how that plays out in terms of the argumentation.
The Mishnah says specifically that they did not call two witnesses.
So. Right, so that's the question. It does say he could convene a court elsewhere. Okay, Hayao say veitin b'makom acher. It does say veitin. But in this case, whether or not veitin means... Honestly, a court of three, in the way we understand an odd number to make a decision in legal sense, whether or not Beit Din then becomes a term that's a little looser too in its reality. Maybe I just need a quote-unquote, I need a Beit Din. The Beit Din in this situation is two witnesses. Listen to how it unfolds the conversation. Rav Sheshet said he has to go on and peddle you. Each of the three, he's simply putting it formulaically to say, write the documents with the names of the people who were there in the place where they are. That's how we write a prosbul. That's how we write this document. And you can't tell me you can just have two people to witness this. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says in response, Mina amin Allah. From where do I derive my opinion? Deet nan. I learn at the end of that Mishnah. You brought me that Mishnah? Let's talk about that Mishnah. Hadayanim chot min lamata. The judges sign below the text of the prose bowl. O ha'edim. Or the witnesses sign it. Oh. My love dayanim dumya le'edim. Does it not mean that judges are similar to witnesses? Ma'edim shnayim. Just as witnesses are two. Af dayanim nami shnayim. So too can I say that these two are really like judges and not exactly like witnesses. So in a certain way, yeah, they're witnesses, but really I'm calling them dayanim. I'm calling them judges for the purpose of this act. The prosable, and now the act of canceling a get before Rav Gamliel changed the whole system. Why is it important to understand then that Tikkun Olam in or with its power has some very interesting power in terms of the whole system of rabbinic legal life? Or how do we say that Tikkun Olam works in terms of the accepted rabbinic legal system? I think we can say a little bit, or at least it's hinting at this point, that Tikkun Olam, that putting a fix on something, helps tighten up the system, because if you're going to say a Beit Din can be two, I really have to change this system. If we were to go with what it says right here, right now, and Rav Nachman's response to Rav Sheshit, I might think that a Beit Din could really be two. That's not exactly what we assume all over the Talmud. We assume it's three. Pretty hard and fast. So maybe Tikkun Olam in a certain way, and we're exploring this, maybe Tikkun Olam is coming to fix some of that gray area of what Beit Din really meant in the Mishnah.
So in the realm of Tikkun Olam, is it possible with a prosbul or with a get that someone could say, listen, I'm going to make this deal with you, but the agreement is no prosbul. We're going to stick to the agreement and...
You mean, could they do that?
Yes. Can an agreement be made in advance that we're not going to consider a prosbul? And in the marriage agreement, just so we understand, there'll never be again.
I think what happens generally in terms of the system here is that when the rabbis have legislation, you can't put a clause in that nullifies rabbinic law. You could see over the course of generations or centuries how a person might have made an agreement that seemed to nullify the possibility for a later piece of legislation. But generally, once legislation is crafted, it would be difficult to go completely against that grain. Now, that's not to say that some tried to buck the system. And we've mentioned this. And it was mentioned here again. What happens if the old system was used, even though Rabban Gamliel made the new system and put it into place? What if someone did convene a Beit Din? However you understand Beit Din. That's still a question.
We have the same issue in informed consent for people participating in studies. And we are always on the lookout for what we call exculpatory language. So in other words, if someone is participating in the study and a piece of their tissue is taken out and one day that gets converted into intellectual property, you can't put in the consent that they're giving away the rights to that. You have to leave that to be decided in a different context. So we don't allow people to give away their rights in certain situations. And so, and if you don't have that, then you wind up with unequal contractual relationships that destroy all of the law that you wanted to create.
Mm. And the intent of the law.
What was that famous case that was written up, the whole book about this woman's tissue
That black Rieta Lex.
Lex, right.
So that's the one that hit the press, but there actually been some that have been adjudicated.
Mm-hmm.
University of California case was the most...
David Goldie, my boss.
What?
David Goldie.
Yeah, David
my
Goldie.
My boss.
A friend. So, who was sued. But the point is that as a matter of principle, we don't allow exculpatory language, and we don't allow letting the institution of the leader in an informed consent process.
Me. Henry?
Even by mutual consent?
Well, the consent is not that mutual.
It's not informed enough.
You know, that the structure of the relationship is such that it won't be mutual. So that's where we try to protect the individual.
Right, that's somewhat different. It's coercive.
Okay, well, I have a lot to say, but since Tikkun Olam is the subject of the class, I may be jumping off to try to solve the solution to this, but
uh-huh.
It seems to me that the Tikkun Olam that we've been talking about here, the Tikkun Olam we usually think about in the modern age is putting the pieces back together, repairing things that have been broken.
Uh-huh.
And the Tikkun Olam we're talking about here is actually keeping things from falling apart. So in the case of the get and the woman, it's so that things don't happen that would shatter the civil harmony of society by allowing her to get... And with regard to the protocol, it's to prevent the functioning of society by allowing people to give loans to people and have the resources for what they need, because if people start giving loans, it would shatter the, you know, that aspect of society. Is that, I mean, when you had in mind the difference between the Kuhn and the Lum that we think about and what rabbis think about, is that sort of...
Yeah, we're observing along the way exactly the kind of pieces that the observations you're making.
Mm-hmm.
We want to start to define what really is rabbinic tikkun olam vis-a-vis the Mishnah. So you could just call it the fabric of society at this point, meaning a thriving economic society, a family-oriented society. These are things that I think do come out. I would say, at the heart of it, you even have to look at what type of progress this meant in terms of men and women. Even though it's not as forward as we would imagine ourselves to be today, what are they thinking about in terms of protecting a woman and protecting a child?
I think of a question, how eligible is a woman who had been divorced? Because we're talking about her getting married and having little children, but she's no longer a maiden. I don't think she's in this, quality of what she can't marry a Cohen,
right.
But how marriageable is a divorced woman in the time of the Talmud?
Well, we have to remember that death among women in childbirth was much more prevalent.
Right.
Let's begin there. Number two, there is language for other than betulta, other than first-time women getting married. That is very popular within ketubot from throughout the ages. So the answer, according to social history...
In the ketubah?
Yeah. If there are different words for people who are either getting married for the first time or getting married afterwards.
The
value is the husband, right?
What would the word translate as?
Widow. You can write in the word widow.
Yeah, but that's not divorced, right?
Right. You don't write in divorced. That status we don't want to grant somebody because we don't want to remind her of the first wedding, actually. But you wouldn't call her a virgin. You would say the woman. You would say the widow. You would say the bride. There were different languages. Today, if you look at documents that are used to prepare ketubot, or the books that I take to weddings where I have to prepare the ketubah in terms of the blanks that they leave for the rabbi. So there are lists of different potential words that you fill in depending on someone's status in these regards.
Today, if you're marrying a woman that had been divorced, what would you fill in?
Most likely the woman or the partner. You know, there's language that we could generously translate as such, especially in egalitarian circles where we've updated language and we're not just using language found in ketubot from 2,000 years ago, though all the other language surrounding it is language from thousands of years ago. Plus, remember, in this whole mix, I don't know if people know this, but we have what's called the Lieberman Clause in conservative movement ketubot, which is a clause that calls for the Beit Din to deliver a get if a husband will decide to become recalcitrant. The Beit Din of America, the Rabbinical Assembly Beit Din.
Without the consent.
Without the consent of the husband.
But he gives his consent ahead of time.
He gives his consent through signing onto this ketubah. Not that he feels that it's a consensual act at the time that the Beit Din has to deliver a get in for him.
It's a prenup. Straight away his rights. I was going to say, definitely exculpatory
language. It's not legal to do something.
Class actions.
In terms of the religious, in terms of what we feel is religiously legal, we absolutely feel that nullifying an original marriage is one way of getting a woman out of a marriage where she remains a chained woman to a husband who won't deliver a get. Again, we believe that it is legal to nullify an original marriage in order to free a woman from a marriage wherein a husband is refusing to give a get.
Sounds very Christian. Sounds like the Pope.
However, because we didn't want to go with that position as the only position, Dr. Lieberman, blessed memory, genius, Gaon, came up with a formula that is the mechanism that allows for the Beit Din to, on behalf of a husband, deliver a get. There's nothing really that exculpatory about it. He agrees to it when he agrees to accept that ketubah condition. He's agreed to it. So that's the difference, we would say. Just to finish up this part of the conversation, because with the time left, I want to push us to the Tikkun Olam section that I wanted to get to on the right-hand side of the page. Bottom line is that about the prosbul, they say, listen, if it was formulated that witnesses were there to witness this prosbul, if it was formulated that judges were there to say it was before this Beit Din, and two witnesses sign below the witnesses' language above, or three judges sign below witnesses' language, or language from this one, and it was out. It's all kosher. They made it easier to make sure alone was safe in the Beit Din's trust, and so that you would loan money and that people still had to pay it back. The Mishnah states, Mivnei Tikkun Olam, right-hand side, 33A1. For the sake of the benefit of society, or for the sake of fixing the world, the husband must inform the shaliach himself or go to the wife himself. That's the new system. We say it's for Tikkun Olam. What's really meant by this for the benefit of society or the benefit of the olam, the world? Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Mipnei Takanat Mamzerim. We talked about this, but I want you to see it inside. He said it's to forestall or prevent the problem of Mamzerim, that is, kids who are forbidden to marry within the normative Jewish congregation. But Reish Lakish Amar, and Reish Lakish says, Mipnei takana agunot, it's for the fact that we don't want to protect against agunot. Agunot meaning a woman who is anchored to her husband because he will not deliver a get. But they are not, for all intents and purposes, living together and not married, and there's no productive relationship, and she's simply chained and cannot go and get remarried.
As points out, they don't even know if he's alive.
One case would be that a soldier might go off to battle. We don't know if he's dead or just missing in action. And then she's chained because he hasn't issued a get. He didn't divorce her before he left. This is an ancient way of dealing with this problem, by the way, according to the Gemara, who retroactively said about many soldiers in King David's time that they obviously gave gets to their wives before they went off to battle. So that if there's any question about whether they're killed or whether they're missing in action, the women were all free to marry. We don't really know how ancient that practice is or if that practice is for real. What's that?
So what happens when they come back?
Ah, that's the big problem.
Yeah, but we were trying
to the get burning ceremony.
Yeah. Bottom line is that I believe that you're seeing in the footnote. So I was hard pressed to see how that footnote is in play in our situation. Sometimes they just take from other problems, and you know, let me explain what an aguna is. I think here that's just an explanatory note. What an aguna, what she might have as the problem. Our problem actually goes back to what Rashi said, and that is mipnei tikkun olam sheheis shaliach she'eino yodea b'devar molicho la v'hi nisat bo. It either is how Rashi said it, that she's going to get married again because she thought the get was still in play, and she's going to have mamzerian, and Rashi, if we think that Rashi's siding with either one of the two that are in our argument, right, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are having the discussion. Is it for the mamzerian issue? Is it for the children out of wedlock issue that I'm trying to prevent? Or is it for the chained woman who doesn't have her get and is an aguna and is not going to be able to get remarried? If we have to go back and say, what's Rashi thinking that the Mipnei Tikkun Olam problem is, right, on the Mishnah is where I just read, he seems to come down the side that she's going to get married again and have children, quote unquote, who are mamzerim. That was the problem that Rabbi Yochanan pointed to. This aguna problem is the aguna problem that was also pointed to in Rashi's commentary to explain what's really going on with the guy who just runs after his shaliach and nullifies it, right? Because we think, en b'dato levatlo, he doesn't really have in his mind to actually cancel the get completely, nullify, void the document. Ela litza'ura ba'alma, chodesh or chodshayim. That is to give her grief for the next 2-3 months, month or two, that she knows it gets coming, but he's going to keep her an aguna chain. And by the way, it could turn into not only a month or two, it could turn into ages that he's going to give her such tziris. This is a disagreement between Rabbi Yochanan, who says the problem's about these children who will be born, because she'll go and get married, versus this other. Now, here's where, again, I think that we have to think in a larger stroke about a larger sweep about what their positions are and what these positions really represent and as problems, and then what Tikkun Olam really represents as a fix. Because Rabbi Yochanan really believes that the problem's going to be that he really did cancel it. He got two people or three people in his locale. He brought them forward. He said, I'm canceling it. What's the problem? The problem is that there's just no system to get her the legal notice.
But if the get doesn't take effect until it's in her hand,
she's
divorced based on hearsay that it's coming.
Because it's coming, she gets it, and she didn't hear that it was canceled. Yeah, but at that time you didn't need a messenger to run after the messenger to cancel it.
So she would have to get, which had...
And they didn't have news. They didn't have, you know, the court prints out all the news of the day. They were worried that it didn't happen. And because they're expressing that worry here in the Gemara, we can accept, or we have to understand, there was this concern. There were no legal notices posted, and this did happen. And Rashi brings it forward as the problem. She didn't get word that this get that's now in her hand was canceled. Rabbi Yochanan believes that that's the problem. And when she hears that there was a get and doesn't hear that it's canceled, but receives it and thinks it's valid, she'll go get married. And Rabbi Yochanan then really does believe as follows, I think, that he really did intend to nullify the get. I think this is different than Reish Lakish's position, where he says the problem is about agunot. He sees husbands as being recalcitrant. And what he's trying to fix is the problem of a husband who can toy with his wife and is very spiteful and keeps the get for a chodesh, chodshayim, 1 month, 2 months, a little longer. And at the core of the issue for Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish is a fundamental disagreement about what the problem is. Is it a legal systems problem? Or is it the problem with the nature of recalcitrant husbands? And I think that comes through in what can just be read as a fundamental sugiatic disagreement, a Talmudic disagreement about what's really the underlying problem.
So are they saying we have to choose?
That's a good question about Gemara. You know, do we have to choose, or can we go both directions? Can we play out the natural ends of either of these issues and understand them and then hope that there's some greater fix? I think the way that I read Talmud, it's definitely, in my estimation, that they're presenting these two opposing ideas so that we, the reader, really weigh both possibilities. And not only that, but when it's presented in the name of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, that's an even deeper indication of how essential a discussion this is, because Rabbi Yochanan is mentioned all over rabbinic sources, and Reish Lakish was known as an absolutely fantastic chavruta to Rabbi Yochanan. And we're not going to get to it this time, but I want to take a look at who these people were. Who was Rabbi Yochanan? Who was Reish Lakish? And how deeply they felt they needed to come up with an understanding, each on their own, but that really it exists within the presentation of the great Torah of our sages. It's a presentation of the great Torah of our sages to think in both these directions.
Many times I had the feeling that the rabbis were focused on protecting their daughters from their sons-in-law as a theme, as to why they focused on the principles that they developed. So I'll be interested to hear a little bit more about the two personalities in terms of their perspective.
Well, let me tell you something. Rabbi Yochanan ultimately said to Reish Lakish, come marry my sister. So, you know, you may indeed be onto something here.
Yeah. So I want to beg everybody's indulgence and just quickly go through how I understand this. If the wife lived across the town so that it was easy for the individual who's giving the get to actually deliver it himself, then he writes it out, and in order for the get to actually happen, he's got to walk across the town. He's up until the time he actually gets to her doorstep and hands it to her, at any of that, any time he can go back and change his mind and not do it and fine, no issue. if the woman doesn't live across town, so it's not easy, then he needs a shaliach to do this for him. And I think that...
Or he can go to her himself.
Well, he can always go to her himself. But if she doesn't live where he can go across town, for whatever reason, it's not practical for him to do it himself, then he needs a shaliach. He needs an agent to do it for him. And then the issue becomes, and it's really, there's a mindset. I mean... one could say that you need at that point both the document and an intent for him to for that get to be delivered. And we tell the agent, go deliver it, there's an intent at that point. And some rabbis might think that if his intent changes, even though the shaliach is on his way and he can't even reach that, his intent changes, and then he goes to a Beit Din, and you know, his intent is different, and one might say that that's legitimate, that he can cancel the get because his intent changed. But then, you know, then this tikkun olam thing comes in, where are we doing something that's violating the order of the world here? And the one rabbi says, look, you know, if she gets it, and we have, you know, in real estate, you have the concept, once the title officer says, you own the property, you know, there's got to be a moment when that is a valid thing. Mm-hmm. So the title officer has the ability, and me as the owner, I could change my mind, whatever, but if the umpire, he says, you're out, or, you know, so that gets it done. So, you know, she has a right to believe, and some may think that, you know, that's a key thing, where if she's under misperception and then goes against marriage. And the other thing is Reish Lakish, where he's worried, where the guy can, understanding these rules that would allow him to go to a Beit Din and cancel it, he can actually abuse the rule by knowing that it's going to take the shaliach 3 days to get to the wife, and 2 days later, he's going to go to that Beit Din and he's going to say, no, I changed my mind. So that's also violating the civil order, where he's tormenting the wife.
Yeah, you're coming at it from the different angles, and they're trying to guard against it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So those are the two possibilities.
Exactly. All right.
Yeah. Just from what he said, the fact that they used the word Beit Din, doesn't it become the responsibility of the court then, or someone in there, to ensure that the woman is notified properly rather than the husband at that point?
Yeah, one would have hoped, and the problem was...
Because it used those words instead of witnesses.
Right, and the problem was...
But it kept insisting it's a court, so with talking about the incident, whether or not the children are then bastards or whatever... It's not really the husband's responsibility at that point, and it should be someone from the court that notifies him one way or the other.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, we see within the spirit here of the language and in the context of our legal analysis that it wasn't happening, that the court really either took that responsibility or at least had the means by which to really make that happen. And that was the problem that they're trying to guard against, that she wouldn't get word. And that's, you know, that's Rabbi Yochanan, who says then there's going to be mamzerim. There's going to be a problem.
Everything we've been talking about seems to assume that all of this exists parallel with and separate from civil law related to marriage in the country in which the Jews are residing. To what extent was that the reality? And at what point, if any, were there, in fact, the requirement to deal with the reality of the civil law being superior?
Even now,
well,
the situation
I think we could, let's fast forward to a minute to the age of Mendelssohn. 19th century. End of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. I fast forward us there because those are the moments in our history where our own civil and criminal court systems are really called into question by the emerging nation state. We really do, until that time, either have charters or are granted permission or determine that we are going to have our own working judicial system in order to deal with matters of marriage and divorce, commerce, many times crime. It's not to say that we did not have a principle within Jewish law called Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law, when A, we like the law of the land and we wanted to invoke it and we applied it, or B, when someone was dealing with someone outside the community or between communities and there was a party or various parties to matters that needed adjudication in non-Jewish courts. But I use that example of in the Enlightenment moment to say that the nation-state status really changed the way Jewish, private Jewish matters under the law were considered to be either state business or not. And we have to recall those moments as the breakdown of these systems. So we are talking about very, very much a legal system that is in effect for our people. And the different practices that happen around different parts of the Jewish world are being unified by the rabbis of the great academies, in this case, of Babylonia. And legislation will follow everywhere from commentators on the Gemara to the Rambam to the ultimate statement of the Shulchan Aruch that really reflect some of what we've been learning already in this Masechta. I'm going to respect the time here and say it is sweet to be learning again, and it's great to see everybody back who joined post the first week, and we continue next time with selections from amidst this material and a little bit of sidebar material about what does it mean to have an agent who represents you legally within our tradition. And I want to talk a little bit more about Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish.
Thank you.
Baal Tov.
No, this is not happening.